Scott Spears back with you here for hour number two of the big program today on this Wednesday, February the 6th, 2019. 13 coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, and we have got a great guest this hour. But before we do that, do want to reiterate the announcement that we made this morning that on Friday, March the 1st, that will be the 25th anniversary of the swearing-in of Mary Ellen Withrow as the 40th Treasurer of the United States. Now, we're going to celebrate that here at the station in a big way, as myself, Charlie Evers, Terry Tackett, and Sean Kraft will be going to Toledo, Ohio on March the 1st to do a live remote from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. from the most famous hot dog restaurant in the world, Tony Paco's. Now, as many of you know, Tony Paco's is very famous for having celebrities, politicians, and well-known people come in and sign hot dog buns, which are displayed on their walls. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan is there, Burt Reynolds is there, Mr. T is there, and on Friday, March the 1st, Mary Ellen Withrow will join that group as she will be signing a hot dog bun that will be displayed at Tony Paco's forever. That presentation will happen during our live broadcast, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. What fun that is going to be. You can listen over the air at 107.1.com. or live on the internet, wwgh1071.com. That's the web address. We'll stream live there. And or you can listen on your favorite mobile device by downloading the free TuneIn app and searching WWGH. Live from Tony Paco's, Friday, March the 1st, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., celebrating the 25th anniversary of Mary Ellen Withrow being sworn in as the 40th Treasurer of the United States. And there may be some surprises that day as the hot dog bun is signed. Now, speaking of interesting things, last night was the delayed State of the Union address that President Trump gave. First time he gave that State of the Union address in front of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It was a very interesting evening, to say the least, and no better person to sort all that out with than with a great friend of this program. She is a reporter, writer for the Daily Beast, panelist on the long-running television series The McLaughlin Group, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good. Glad to be with you. You said the president was delivering the speech in front of Nancy Pelosi. That was literally in front of. She was over his shoulder the entire time. An hour and 20 minutes, I think it was.
Now, that dynamic was interesting because as I watched all of the news yesterday leading up to the event, there was this discussion that you would have the Vice President, Nancy Pelosi, and President Trump in the shot, and that they don't see eye to eye, President Trump and Nancy Pelosi, on a lot of things, and that her facial expressions might give her away. How do you think that went?
I think they were both respectful and stayed within bounds, although I must say on the internet this morning, Nancy Pelosi gave what seemed to be, there's an internet meme for it, a kind of a backhanded clap to the president, which seemed at the same time to be rebuking him. And it's taken off on social media, and with the conclusion that Nancy Pelosi won in their smackdown in the chamber. But it didn't amount to that. I mean, the president basically stayed within the bounds of State of the Union speeches, you know, reciting his accomplishments, exaggerating them a bit, and then with these sort of very American moments honoring people that are heroes to both Republicans and Democrats. But then he got in his jabs, and the jabs about the ridiculous partisan investigations, and he made it clear he's not giving anything on the wall, and basically said if he doesn't get his way, and if the Congress proceeds to go to war with him, which is how he sees it, he doesn't see how they're going to be able to accomplish anything. So he went in there, I think, with the goal of expressing unity and comedy. Those were the two buzzwords that the White House kind of put out before the speech. But he every time he made a gesture towards the other side, he kind of stepped on it with his obsession about the wall and investigations. And on immigration, of course, he returned to many of the themes that we've all heard many times. But he added a new wrinkle this time of talking about it in class terms, that feelings about immigration divide between working class people and the elites and the politicians who he said live behind walls and gated and live in gated communities, and really reminded me of the days of George Wallace, who used to campaign. He was the Alabama segregationist governor, and he used to campaign against what he called the limousine liberals in the East, who all sent their children to private schools and wanted everybody else to go to integrated schools. So these are kind of familiar divisive themes that we've heard in America before, but we don't usually hear them at the State of the Union.
There were two things just from the visual of the whole thing that I thought were interesting. One, I heard a lot of people talking about this morning, was when Nancy Pelosi would stand up, which wasn't every time everybody stood up, to clap, that she would stay standing up, kind of shuffling these papers that President Trump had got a copy of the speech.
Right.
What was going on there, do you think?
I think she was probably looking to see where he was in the speech and how much longer it was going to be, and maybe she was also looking to see where he was departing from the prepared text and going off on his own. That's what I'm assuming she was doing. But she was pretty conscious most of the time that the cameras were going to be on her, so I didn't think she carried that too far, but I did notice it. It was as though she was getting a little impatient, like, you know, where are we in this text? How much longer do we have to sit here? That was the message I took from it.
The other thing that I noticed last night that I didn't hear too much talk about this morning was obviously when President Trump would say something, the Republicans would get up. Sometimes the Democrats would, but not very often. And when he would talk about things like the wall or the investigation, the Democrats, they were almost going to boo, and Nancy would hold up her hand in that direction as don't do that. Get too out of hand. Did you?
Yeah. I didn't notice that, but it wouldn't surprise me that ahead of time that she tried to calm the passions on her side of the aisle. And I thought the fact that the women all dressed in white, and when they didn't agree with something, they were silent, and they just sat there, it reminded me of the what they call the silent sentinels, was the suffragists who used to parade outside of the White House during the Woodrow Wilson administration, trying to get him to support women's right to vote. That's 100 years ago, so we had the image of the silent sentinels in white in the House chamber. Although when the president did talk about the gains that women have made in employment and more women created their own businesses, boy, well, those silent sentinels leapt to life. And I think the president was a little taken aback by that, but it was a nice moment.
And then when he did recognize that more women were in Congress now, the chance of USA, I thought that was a unique moment.
Yes, exactly. That's a chant that's always been identified with the Republican side, and so it was nice the Democrats could join in there as well. That was good.
Watching it on television, what do you think the general feeling in the room was?
I just think there's a huge skepticism about whatever he says and whatever it means. I mean, he can toss out all this very nice language about the need to come together and repudiating, you know, revenge politics, and this is a unique moment in history and all of that. But you know that it's just words to him, and it's not coming from any great core of belief, because the expectation is that he could turn around in 24 hours or 48 hours and begin to do all the things that he's just said he wished we could put behind us. So he doesn't have any credibility. And I think his own party doesn't know what to trust when he says something. The deadline for the coming together on the budget is February 15th, but it's really more like February 8th if they're going to go through all the legislative maneuvers. And Republicans don't know if the vice president is speaking for the president or his son-in-law. So I think there's a lot of skepticism about him on the Republican side, too. But they sure were determined to show that they're unified last night. There was an applause line every 2 seconds, it seems, at the beginning of the speech, and the Republicans were just leaping to their feet. I think they wanted to demonstrate to the Democrats that there are no significant cracks yet in their solidarity.
As we head into a possible, the deadline, February the 15th, as we head that way, it doesn't seem like we've gotten anywhere from where we were when the government opened back up. What do you foresee happening in the next few days?
Well, we've gotten somewhere in the sense that Nancy Pelosi pretty decisively won that round, and so her credibility is now quite high. And the president seemed to leave the door open last night for him to declare a state of emergency, which I don't think is all that bad a thing for him to do. I mean, I'm not for it, but I think it's the best of worst options. I believe it would be instantly challenged in the courts. I think it's unlikely it would survive. It would give him one last-ditch chance to get the money for his wall. And if the courts and the Democrats refuse to go along with it, he can then go into the next election saying, you know, reelect me and we'll get the proper wall built, I'll promise you the wall. So the wall seems to be his main political issue. And what's different now with the Democrats in charge of the House, that a state of emergency can be challenged in both chambers of the Congress. It's a president's declaration like that has never been challenged before, but it would just take a majority vote. So I could see that passing in the House and the Senate, and the president could veto it, and then it would take a two-thirds to overrule it, which would probably be unlikely. But if he goes ahead, he could be challenged by significant numbers within his own party. And I think that must be what he's weighing, because I think he talks about worrying about impeachment, but impeachment is really doesn't have any teeth unless you have significant erosion among Republicans in the Senate. And so if he goes ahead with this declaration of emergency, that should flush out just how strong the support for him remains in the Senate. I think it's probably still there, but he's taking a risk if he goes ahead with that state of emergency. But I don't see how else he gets out of the hole he's dug. There's no reason for Pelosi and the Democrats to give in. They're winning so far.
You know, it's very interesting. The day the government reopened, it is exactly, I think, the problem we're having in the government since, I'm going to say, the Monica Lewinsky scandal, is that the president did what everybody was screaming he needed to do. Open back up the government and don't get a dollar for your wall. Don't worry about that. Open up the government. He did that, and not only did his detractors attack him, but his friends attacked him. Ann Coulter, bigger wimp than George H.W. Bush. Lou Dobbs said Nancy Pelosi beat him up. You know, it's interesting because you think people for over 30 days said, do this, open it up, open it up, open it up, don't worry about the wall. And the second he did it, he got it from both sides.
Right, but he was ready to sign legislation that had been approved by both the Democratic House and the Republican Senate, and he changed that at the last minute because he got pushback from Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and his Lou Dobbs and his friends on the right. So that's what precipitated the whole shutdown crisis to begin with. You would hope that a president would know enough not to be led around by the nose by a handful of right-wing radio talk show hosts. I mean, it's, and television too, I guess. And they're not even that popular anymore among the base. I think Ann Coulter's kind of out there on her own, yelling for Trump not to give in to anything. So, I go back to Ronald Reagan, and he used to talk about, he called them the so-called conservatives who wanted him to go leaping off the cliff with the flag flying. And his attitude was always, you can't get 100%, you take 80% or 60%, and then you come back for more. So he knew enough to push back against the hard right. This president is scared of the hard right because he thinks that they are representative of his rock-solid base, and that base remains rock-solid at probably 35%, that no matter what he does, they're with him, and he doesn't want to lose that. So it's really kind of absurd that a few talk show hosts can have this power. I'm not sure his base actually ever thought he was completely serious about a wall anyway.
Eleanor, when this speech was over last night, this is what I thought about, because I think history is important. I thought of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton as more pragmatic presidents, that they had their beliefs, and they didn't always get what they wanted, but they got some of what they wanted, and they were willing to make deals. I don't consider George W. Bush a pragmatist. I don't really consider President Obama a pragmatist. And I think President Trump is a pragmatist because a lot of the things he said, like criminal justice reform, infrastructure, could have come out of a Democratic speech, but it seems to be these people that you speak of who stop him from being a pragmatist.
Well, I don't know that pragmatist is the right word. Barack Obama and George W. Bush knew how to count votes, and if they didn't have the votes, that was it. George W. Bush wanted to do immigration reform very badly, and he didn't have the votes for it. He even paired himself with Ted Kennedy and John McCain, and legislation did pass in the Senate, eventually under Barack Obama, but George W. Bush was never able to get that through. And Obama made lots of deals. They were generally done at the end of the year. His vice president, Joe Biden, who was a creature of the Senate, was always the negotiator. And he kept some of the tax cuts for the rich that George W. Bush had passed in exchange for, I think he wanted, it was a long-range treaty with Russia, whatever. I mean, yeah, they made deals because they knew how to count votes. This president doesn't want to acknowledge that he doesn't have the votes. The Republicans, when they had both the House and the Senate, didn't give him his wall either because the wall doesn't make sense. It's too expensive, and you can protect the border in other ways. So, he's just taking a purely political stand. And I don't know, he boasts that he's this big deal maker, but you look at his business background, he declared bankruptcy a number of times, and often he used to claim he never settled out of court. I think, didn't he settle out of court in Trump University? And of course now he's got all these investigations coming after him. Let's see how good a deal maker he is there.
Well, what I was mostly referring to, what it seems to me is, obviously, with the passing of George H.W. Bush, we all remembered, read my lips, no new taxes, but he did it anyway because he had to. He knew it was best for the country. I mean, Clinton compromised on some things that he wouldn't have compromised if the Democrats had held the House and the Senate. But George W. Bush, I think of the Iraqi war, I think of the Patriot Act, you know, he got those things in while he had Republican houses and senates. May not have happened if it was Democratic. Obama got the Affordable Care Act in, but he had to have a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. They got big things done, W. Bush and Obama, but it kind of alienated the other side, and then for the rest of their terms, they lost power and couldn't get anything done.
Yeah. Well, that may be true, but the fact that Bill Clinton was able to get things done even when he was in the midst of impeachment, politicians act out of self-interest. You know, what's good for them? And I must say, I think really with Clinton, the sort of the right-wing attack machine really went into high gear. And then with Mitch McConnell declaring when Obama was first inaugurated that his main goal was to see him fail. Stacey Abrams last night, by contrast, she was a gubernatorial candidate who came in short. She's likely going to run for the Senate in 2 years, but she gave the Democratic response, and she made a point of saying about President Trump that she doesn't want him to fail. She just wants him to tell the truth. So, I mean, I think there are, you know, different ways you can look at this, but I think Bill Clinton reached across the aisle a lot. In fact, the term that was attached to it was called triangulation, because he often cut out congressional Democrats. And Barack Obama tried very hard to get Republican support for the health care bill, and he believed for quite a long time that he was going to get it, and then finally he didn't. And critics say that he counted too much on what he thought was a bipartisanship that he could bring about. I think the Republican Party was determined to block him at every turn. So if he hadn't moved to get what he could on Obamacare, he wouldn't have gotten anything. And the legislation is flawed. And you should have the two parties go back together to fix what's wrong, because the American people are the ones who pay the price for the flaws in the legislation. And the president is still vowing to, I think, didn't he say just recently, I don't think it was in the State of the Union, but he said recently that Obamacare is going to die in the courts or something to that effect.
Well, it was interesting to me because there were points, criminal justice reform, and at one point President Trump said even though he wants to build a wall, he wants more immigrants legally to come in this country than ever before. Also talking last night about money for cancer research, talking about keeping the pre-existing condition issue, that it won't keep you away from insurance. You know, those tended to be the pullout of Syria. It didn't seem like his Republican counterparts were all that happy with those issues.
No, and let's see if he follows through. You know, it's easy to just give voice to those issues. I'm still waiting for the legislation to protect people with pre-existing conditions who need health insurance. We haven't seen that yet. That may be initiated in the House by the Democrats, and then we'll see if the Republicans vote for it. He also called for money for parental leave, which is an issue that his daughter Ivanka has pushed. But if you talk to people up there and you ask them, well, what is the dollar figure, or where does it fit in? The White House, unlike past White Houses, they don't seem to have any legislative muscle behind anything. You know, they don't offer up proposals. They don't, you know, work with legislative language. It's mostly just rhetoric. And I think the president kind of operates that way. He thinks if he says it, it must be true, and therefore it happens. That's not the way government works. You have to get buy-in from all kinds of quarters, and he's not adept at doing that. In fact, the revelation this last week of his schedules for the last several months, you know, unlike past presidents, again, you don't have the meetings with congressional leaders, you don't have briefings on this topic and that topic, you have a lot of what is euphemistically called executive time, where he takes in information by talking to people on the phone, and he has a whole circle of people I think he checks in regularly, and he watches television. So it leaves kind of some pretty big gaps in his knowledge.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I guess this comes back to what I was saying before. It's hard to tell as you said, it was the Ann Coulters, it was the Lou Dobbs, it was the Rush Limbaughs that caused him not to sign the original deal that did not include the Wall.
That he had originally agreed to.
Right, that he had agreed to. So I believe the president agreed that he thought it was okay not to get the Wall until people started attacking him. I don't know what he believes, because last night he got up and said the things we just discussed, parental leave, cancer research, pre-existing condition protection, all those things. Now, what does Donald Trump believe? And what is the party and his friends allowing him not to do? There's a big confusion there.
I think what he believes is whatever will keep his base of support happy. I think he thinks that was his ticket to election, and that is his only path to re-election. And so everything goes through that prism as to will my base like it. And he did the immigration scaremongering last night on that. He raised the abortion issue in some pretty graphic terms last night, and then went after the investigations. Considering this was Donald Trump, those three areas were, at least in terms of words, were relatively small parts of the speech. I mean, I think overall he probably thinks that he did this huge bipartisan olive branch by talking about other issues of common ground, the HIV initiative, talking about, you know, bringing drug prices down. When he said that, my mind flashed back to Bill Clinton in 1993 talking about Hillary's health care plan, and Republicans were sitting on their hands then. They wouldn't be cheering about going after the drug companies. So that's a big change, and I think that's probably a hard pill for Republicans to swallow, actually. And the president's Health and Human Services Secretary Azar, does have a credible plan to at least cut out some of the middlemen who represent drug manufacturers and hike up prices in pharmacies. So they are making some progress there. So there are some areas where the two parties can work together, but then he kind of throws down the gauntlet and says you can't have war and peace together. You can't have a warring party and a party that does bipartisan things if you have these, as he put it, ridiculous partisan witch hunts. So it sounds as if he's saying, you know, keep coming after me on the investigations and don't give me the Wall, and nothing's going to happen between the Congress and the White House. And that's probably the likely path, because they're not going to stop the investigations, and Pelosi's not going to give on the Wall, although, you know, they do talk about a smart wall, and there are areas where there should be a wall, and there probably is a wall. but you would think they could figure out a way to sort that out. So I haven't given up on that entirely, but let's see.
It's interesting. Since last we spoke, Roger Stone has been indicted. And also, the Attorney General, Acting Attorney General, said he thinks the Mueller probe is coming to an end, but we don't know if that's true or not. What are you hearing as far as the indictment of Roger Stone, him declaring innocence? Could there possibly be a pardon there? And do you think the Mueller probe is about over?
You know, what they said about what they retrieved from Roger Stone's home in Florida, it was a word I never used before, like trigabytes or something, like it was so much computer material. It sounds like that would take a while to go through. But I think it's possible that they could wrap this up by spring, early spring, which is not that far away. I do think that's possible, and it would be timely and probably a good idea. Interesting, in today's Washington Post, I don't know if you caught up with it, but it's a front page story that goes into long takeout inside the paper about Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of the Washington Post and Amazon, mega billionaire, I guess, and his affair was recently outed in the National Enquirer, and so he's launching an investigation as to how that had happened, and there, the paper, and I give the paper credit for reporting on itself, and they talk about all of the tentacles of who might have leaked this information, and gosh, Roger Stone pops up in that too. Anyway, Roger Stone and the National Enquirer and those National Enquirer's role in sort of burying stories about Donald Trump's extracurricular activities that came up, I guess, in the reporting some months ago. So there's so many aspects to this that will, I'm thinking that Mueller will keep it pretty narrow and report primarily on collusion between Russia and the campaign, and then see how actively that was encouraged on each side. And then I'm thinking he also will follow the money and try to understand the financial ties between the various players in Russia and Ukraine, between them and players in the Trump campaign and Trump himself.
Roger Stone is interesting to this degree. He was on this program November 19th. We did an interview with him. At that time, he said he didn't feel he'd be indicted. And when he was indicted, the thing that struck me was, having Roger on the show, you know, over the years, that he did have so much information lying around, even though he did know this investigation was going on. And is there any chance that President Trump wouldn't pardon him if they were going to send him to jail on federal charges?
It depends what else Roger Stone has to say. I don't know, because the pardon is only for federal charges, right?
Right.
And I don't know if Stone is involved in any of the state inquiries. It would seem to me that Stone would be at the top of the list for the president to pardon, and Manafort also, who the president has basically still said nice things about. The only person he has personally condemned is Michael Cohen. It's hard to see that a pardon would emerge there.
If he pardoned Roger Stone, because Roger Stone is somebody who I don't think is even liked by Republicans, would that be seen as okay, that he could get away with doing that?
Roger Stone is seen as a character, and kind of, I don't know that he's disliked by people. People just saw him as a character, and I don't think ever took him that seriously, like he was really a danger to the Republic. And we'll see what comes out in all of this. After it was rumored that the president might pardon Manafort, Paul Manafort, there was a kind of a cursory poll that was done, which basically found that conservatives or the president's base would not approve of pardoning Manafort, which I thought was interesting. So I don't know necessarily that there'd be that much pushback about Roger Stone. I don't know if the average person out there even gets Roger Stone, unless if they've seen the documentary Get Me Roger Stone, they understand his long checkered history. But he doesn't come across as unlikable in that documentary either. So I don't know that he's at the top of mind of most people in the Trump base.
You know, since we last talked as well, certainly the 2020 presidential race has gotten underway. We saw that last night during the State of the Union as the camera went to Kamala Harris, and it went to Gillibrand, and it went to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker. What have you made of the people who've announced and the people? Do you think we'll see Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden? What's the feeling there?
I think Sanders might be looking out there and thinking that Elizabeth Warren has made off with his vote, except she's getting more heat again for her Native American heritage and whether she exaggerated it or not. So he may think that there's that particular lane is still wide open. I think mostly the progressives have jumped into the race so far, and I think what we label, for lack of a better term, the more centrist candidates, Sherrod Brown, Terry McAuliffe, Joe Biden, have not yet fully gone through with their intentions. But I think there's time and there's room for all of those. And I'm with a column written by David Leonhard at the New York Times some weeks ago, and the title of the column was "Run, Joe, Run." Not necessarily that he's going to be the one who gets the nomination, but he does bring, I think, a seasoned quality to the race and a gravitas. And I think if the election were held today and he were on the ballot, he would win. Now, but can he survive, 17, 18 months of scrutiny and debating and all that? I mean, he is one of those politicians who seems to love all that stuff, so maybe he can. But, I think the way I look at it, all of these candidates, it's like chorus line. We're looking not only for a president, but for a vice president and a treasury secretary and a secretary of state to basically repeople a government that's been decimated. So I think there's room for everybody to get out there. And I do think the presidential field could be winnowed pretty quickly. With Iowa still being the first caucuses, the saying about Iowa is there are just three tickets out of Iowa: win, place, and show. 1, 2, 3. If you finish 9 or 10 in Iowa, you really got to do well in New Hampshire or you're going to be gone. So I think the winnowing is probably going to happen pretty quickly.
Eleanor, we've talked about this before, but again, another wrinkle, and here's what I can't understand about the 2020 race and Hillary Clinton. Legitimate news source, Wall Street Journal, back in January, says her advisors close to her, friends to her, say she's not ruling out running again, that she would not get in early, but that after she heard about the Roger Stone indictment and that there might have been some kind of collusion, she wants to do it. It's what she wants to do in her life. She goes to Puerto Rico. She's certainly very active in what she's doing. Now, I certainly understand the common wisdom is why she wouldn't run again. But why doesn't she just... We hear Podesta out there saying, I don't think she'll do it. Her advisors say, we think she's going to do it. Why doesn't she just say, I'm not going to do it? That would put an end to it if she's not going to do it.
I think because she's human, and I do trust John Podesta. He's the most recent word. He said she's not going to do it. She's looking at this. She won 3 million more votes than Trump. Collusion with the Russians clearly had an impact on the race. I mean, I think she feels with a lot of justification that she really got screwed. And if the whole investigative stuff comes to a head with Trump, that really does make his election look illegitimate. Now, the missing part to all of this is the groundswell from the American people. And that's what she would like to hear, and I don't believe it's there, and I don't think whatever Mueller comes out with, it's going to make that materialize. And so I think she's got to come to terms with that, and I think she is and she will. But as a human being, she really did get the shaft, and she would like to think that it could be somehow made right, but there's not a do-over in presidential politics like that.
If the Democrats, if the people get in, like Joe Biden, who has run presidential campaigns before and not done so well, John Kerry is rumored, same thing with him, Bernie Sanders, you can put him in that group, who ran for president, mm-hmm. didn't quite get there. If they get in and nobody's getting traction, one of the things I keep hearing about the new group is that nobody knows who they are. And if nobody's getting traction and things are starting to not look great as we head into the fall, do you think it's an impossibility that she would not run, that there's no chance that she would ever get in there?
I actually think it's an impossibility. I just don't see it. And these people will get known. There will be debates. And so the fact that they aren't known now, this is February of the year before. So they will get known. And, you know, to imagine a scenario where she would come riding in to rescue, you know, the field. I remember in 1988 there was it was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and Patricia Schroeder, a Democratic member of Congress, was the only woman in the race, and that it was, and nobody really was thrilled with any of the guys who were in, and it was called, you know, the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But the media attention will make somebody rise above dwarf level, and I would say that Kamala Harris already has made an impact. She's gotten some criticism from the left of her party that, as the former Attorney General of California, she was too tough a prosecutor, but she had a flawless rollout, and she comes across as very appealing, I would say. And, you know, more people are going to get in, and they're going to get known. And if Biden gets in, I mean, again, I would welcome him in the race, and he might well be the one. Let's see.
What about people like John Kasich, now working at CNN? We did flash on Mitt Romney last night when they talked to, when President Trump was talking about pre-existing conditions. Are those people who have lost before a possibility about getting back in?
I wouldn't discount Romney. We don't know what the state of President Trump's poll ratings will be next year, whether he will be vulnerable to a challenge within the Republican Party. Right now, his poll ratings among self-declared Republicans is like 85%. So a challenge in the primary would be like a suicide mission, given the current numbers. But that primary challenge would occur beginning early next year. We don't know yet what's in the Mueller probe. We don't know yet whether he's going to launch another government shutdown or state of emergency that's going to cost him support among Republicans. So if he looks vulnerable, I can definitely imagine a primary challenge next year. And Romney would be perfect from my perspective, but if you're a Republican, you think Romney represents the dreaded establishment. So unless more Republicans rise up against Trump and want someone who kind of represents a more dignified version of the Republican Party, if those people have got to show up if a challenge to Trump is going to have any impact.
You know, at this point, I think the reason Hillary is not saying no, Romney is not saying no, Kerry, Biden, Kasich, I think what they're all waiting for is the end of the Mueller probe, because I think in some way that could all benefit them. I think their resignation could happen. Impeachment could happen. It could show that there was collusion with Russia. Of course, it might not show that. If it doesn't show that, I think Kasich and Romney are done, and Hillary as well. But if it does, I think it's a different story for all three of them.
Well, agreed. And, you know, I just heard a Democratic pollster speak yesterday. It was kind of off the record, so I'm not going to say his name. But he was saying there's a 1 in 3 chance that Trump doesn't run. And the assumption is that then Pence would get the nomination, but he said the Democrats' worst nightmare would be if Pence doesn't get the nomination, if they could actually get somebody more competitive in there. So I thought that was interesting. So we don't know how the Trump saga is going to unfold. I mean, he's got so many legal issues. The analogy there was, and I think we may have talked about this on the show before, Spiro Agnew, who was the Nixon vice president, he basically did a plea deal over both federal charges and state charges in Maryland that allowed him to resign, and I think he paid a modest fine, and he didn't go to jail. If the president is going to get a negotiated retirement or early release from the presidency, he's going to want some legal guarantees. And, you know, in his interview with the New York Times, was that just this week or late last week, I guess, he said the presidency is a loser. He meant it from the financial perspective. It's been a loser for him and his financial empire. Now, that, to me, kind of sets up an excuse for him to back out of a job that the job's the loser. He's not the loser.
Yeah. It's very interesting because nothing surprises me anymore. It wouldn't surprise me if any of these people got in, because I think we're at a very interesting position. Nobody thought Donald Trump could win. I don't think we ever thought we'd be in a jam like we're in right now with investigations going on. I don't think Hillary Clinton ever thought that this may have been going on behind the scenes at the time. I think it's just a very strange time.
Well, but the Clinton campaign knew that the Russians had hacked the emails and were selectively releasing, you know, John Podesta's emails. So I think they had an idea something was going on, and the president, Obama at the time, did go to the congressional leaders and said he wanted to say something publicly, and McConnell shut him down on that. So there was some knowledge, a forethought, but everyone thought that Hillary easily, and so they didn't want to upset any of the dynamics to fear they might make it worse.
You know, Eleanor, before we part ways here, one of the things that's interesting, because we don't know when the Mueller report is coming, but is there some worry here for President Obama when the Mueller report comes out, which could possibly rub off on Joe Biden, because, as you say, he was president. He did know that the Russians hacked into the emails. We learned later on after the election that there were CIAs guarding polling places on election days because they thought there could be trouble. And yet the American public didn't know. And his FBI director is the one who opened up the case 10 days before the end of the election when he shouldn't have.
Well, the intelligence community, the heads of a couple of those agencies, they did make the information public, and it was made the front page of the New York Times and everything, and that was the same day the Access Hollywood tape came out, which took all of the news attention away from the announcement from the intelligence chief that that Russia was hacking American, you know, the electoral system. And President Obama was certainly in on that. I think he did what he thought was appropriate at the time, but it was in the context of assuming that there was no way that Donald Trump could win.
Well, you know,
now different.
That's the strange thing of it all, is that the day, knowing what they knew that we didn't know, knowing that the Trump campaign was under surveillance, knowing that a lot of these things had gone down, that wasn't public. And when the intelligence report made their findings known, and the Access Hollywood tape and the email dump from WikiLeaks all happened on the same day. This is more than a month before the election. Nobody called attention to that.
No.
And Obama and Comey and the CIA all knew that more than we did at that time. That's what I find strange. When all that happens in one day, that nobody got out of joint and said, "Now wait a second, that's."
Well, they also knew that Trump was under investigation by the FBI,
right?
And they didn't reveal that, but they did reveal about Hillary Clinton, so the reopening. So they didn't treat the two candidates the same. Again, the predication was nobody thought Trump could win.
What a way that turned out.
Yeah, exactly.
Eleanor, thank you for your time. It's always a lot of fun.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Eleanor Clift, always an interesting take. The Pastor Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker is coming up at 3:10 today. More interesting programming right around the bend here. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout on this day.
Fellows, you have 10 days from the day you win the prize to pick the prize up. You can only win once every 30 days. WWGH Radio staff reserved in any and all prizes. The WWGH